You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Officer Barton Hempeldinger, the NYPD helicopter pilot who was shot in the scrotum, made a full recovery and sold the rights to his story, which became a made-for-cable movie, Manhood Down, starring Eric Estrada.
Hyo, the Korean high school student who worked part-time at the wine shop, is now 21 years old and manages one of Horkman's new stores. He is no longer Korean.
Ramon, Ramona, Roman Jr. formed a merengue band called Carlo, Carla, and Carlo Jr.
Charo is still performing. Charo is still performing, using a specially made bulletproof guitar.
When did you learn? Did you just recently learn?
You know something? I never saw these kinds of letters before.
It's like, and usually the way we work it here is you read, you know, horizontally, left to right.
Whoa. We should have spoken in the car about this.
Okay. Anyway.
The Fruxnet computer virus spread rapidly throughout the internet, where its most severe impact was a complete shutdown of both Facebook and Twitter, resulting in a spectacular worldwide increase in worker productivity.
Brian Williams resigned from NBC Nightly News after the Horkman, Peckerman, Ed Begley Jr. presidential race, saying, "I've worked far too hard and far too long to have to cover shit like this." When last seen, he answered to the name Tuffy and was bending balloons at children's birthday parties.
The Mickey Mantle rookie card, which was worth $250,000 before Peckerman inserted it into his anus, was eventually sold at auction for $3.4 million.
The Ed Begley Jr. Sean Penn administration, despite the best of intentions, wound up involving U.S. troops in four new foreign wars, including one with Sweden.
Donald Trump is still at large.
I don't know what happened to my reading abilities.
You're a terrible reader.
Yeah, I've been doing
like
better.
Like in school, did you go to school anywhere? Most people.
Anywhere.
I mean, like in the United States, did you go to school? In Russia or something? One of those countries where they read from the in the opposite direction. You know.
Well, that's why I'm having a problem. Yeah. U.S. territories. Okay, not the mainland.
Okay. Well, anyway, you should work on that.
Because if
we're going to tell people that we're authors of the book, one of us, at least I think we both ought to be able to read. We ought to be.
No, we're authors. We should be able to write.
True, that's true.
Yeah, okay.
And actually, a lot of his work reads as though he can't himself read it.
Dave Barry is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. He's the author of some 30 books. Recent best-selling books include his Peter Pan prequels, written with Ridley Pearson, Dave Barry's History of the Millennium So Far, and I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Alan Zweibel is one of the original Saturday Night Live writers, the winner of multiple Emmy Awards for his television work, which includes The Gary Shandling Show, Monk, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Great Performances. He won the Thurber Prize for his novel, The Other Shulman, and collaborated with Billy Crystal on the Tony Award-winning play, 700 Sundays. Their new book together is called Lunatics. Thank you for joining me, Dave and Alan.
Thanks
for having us.
Now, what in got you guys together to write this book?
I would say Steve Martin, in two words.
I would say, I don't know his middle name, so I'll stick to those two words also, Steve Martin.
Well, yeah. Well, we were both asked to, he was given the Mark Twain Award, and they have a big show in Washington, D.C. This was in like 2005. And Alan and I were both asked to be part of the show. And we met there, and Alan said, I don't remember what he said. To be honest, I don't remember anything he said when we were there, but apparently we became close friends, according to him.
Oh, there's a lot of things that went on between me and him that let's just keep here, okay? But what the essence of it was that we became friends over the next few years, and I finally said to him, let's do something together.
And I said, sure, because I thought that he was lying. And then usually when people say something like that, it's like, oh, let's get together for lunch, whatever, you know, and you say yes, but you don't really think you're ever going to get together. And usually you don't. But he really meant it, which was, it's unusual in the writing world that he wanted to actually get together and write something. And so One point.
Why would I tease you otherwise?
Because usually that's what people say. People are always saying, "Oh, let's do something. Let's work on, you know." And so he came up with this pretty darn good idea.
I would have to agree. Alan, tell us about where did this idea come from?
He came up with 1% of the idea.
Yeah, but
did it come from
the
same
1%? Though his stuff is just, you know, chat. We'll talk later. I try to figure out a couple of things. One was the distance between us. There's 1,500 miles between Jersey and where he lives in Florida. How could that work for us? And what was a common denominator? And his daughter Sophie plays soccer. I had 3 children, all of whom played soccer. So I figured, okay, organized sports for kids, that's not a bad territory. So we came up with an idea where there's a local league, AYSO Soccer League championship game. A 10-year-old girl is called offsides by a ref. When she kicks what would be the winning goal, her father goes nuts, and a feud ensues between the ref and the father. Let's see where it takes us. So we decided to alternate chapters and each be the voice of one person. I was the ref, and Dave was the father.
So he sent me this chapter with his character, whom we named Philip Horkman. And he's the ref. He's a nice guy. He's a lovely man, very straight up by the book, and a decent, caring human being. And he calls us offside. And he doesn't think anything else is going to, I mean, his chapter's like, what a wonderful day. It was a great day. One little tiff with this guy at the soccer game. For my guy, you know, this was the bombing of Dresden. This was a major, horrible thing. My guy is not at all like Philip Horkman. His name is Jeffrey Peckerman, and he is a nasty, racist, horrible man, profane individual, doesn't like this call, and he gets very upset. And his version of it is he'd like to kill Horkman. But they don't, you know, they confront each other, and that's, you know, it ends. They don't ever expect to see each other again, except for one little thing, which was that Philip Horkman, tell them what Philip Horkman does for a living.
Philip Horkman owns a pet store.
Called?
The Wine Shop.
Because?
Because when he was opening it, he borrowed money from his in-laws, whose last name was Wine. And they said, sure, you can have the money as long as our name is in the title, okay, is in the store's name. So you have a place called the Wine Shop, which sells iguanas and salamanders and macaws.
And at one point he says that, you know, he told them he wanted it to be called a pet store. And they said, well, then he should borrow the money from somebody named Pet. But anyway, so my guy, they've had their confrontation. They leave the soccer game. And my guy, this is like the next day. My guy was coming home from his job, which is he's a forensic plumber. This is what happens if there's a crime committed involving plumbing. Let's say a person is killed in connection with a toilet. And this does happen more than you might think. A forensic plumber would be called in to testify either for the prosecution or the defense. And that's what my guy does for a living. He's very proud of his profession, as even though he doesn't get a ton of respect for it, which is one of the reasons he's so bitter. He's driving home. And his wife tells him that she's having her book club that night, so he should stop and pick up a bottle, some wine for the ladies to drink during, because they really drink a lot during the book club. So he pulls into a shopping center unfamiliar to him and sees a sign that says The Wine Shop. And thus fate brings these two men back together again. And immediately there is trouble. It escalates. A lemur becomes involved. And before we know it, these two men, again, who have really had no intention of ever seeing each other again, become involved in what is believed to be a terrorist incident. And within a matter of days, they have accidentally hijacked a clothing optional cruise ship.
From there, the book gets a little odd. Okay, up till there, it just, everything falls into place. Just beautifully.
There, it's pretty much, it's almost classic Greek tragedy.
Yeah, it's almost that trite at that point.
But this is fairly early on that this happens.
Now, each of you had to establish a separate voice in the prose. And it's clear you each had a lot of fun. Actually, you know, on the way in, I was trying to figure out who did what. I had it wrong. I had it
really
exactly backwards.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
And what did you base that assumption on? I'm just curious.
I pulled it from the same place that Peckerman put the card.
Yeah.
So,
I get it totally.
Given that... Alan, tell us about creating this nice guy, because he's really funny. And this is a delicate balancing act you pull here. For all the times that I felt like I was going to rupture some part of my anatomy that I prefer not to rupture while reading this, I had to step back and think, wow, this is a pretty complicated and smart little machine they've got going.
Well, what happened with that character, it sort of made sense to me that if the father of this girl was going to go nuts, all right, maybe he is some sort of, over-the-top, bombastic kind of guy. So I figured that let's make this guy, pretty much by the numbers, does things, good citizen, and a good family man. And at the end of the day, watches Sound of Music with his family, and he's Barney Fife. He's just this good guy, and at night he and his wife spoon and life is wonderful. It just seemed sort of, first of all, that's sort of where I live as a writer, okay? Not Barney Fife necessarily, but...
Do you spoon with your wife?
Yeah, on Thursdays.
Spoon night.
Spoon night. Thursdays we spoon, right before, because on Friday we're not allowed to, Jews are not allowed to spoon after
up.
The sun comes down. Yeah, on Friday night.
But we're not going there.
Okay, I'm going to come back. So here I am. So I wrote the guy like that. It just seemed somebody that, once again, I knew that Dave's character would be loud if he's going to be so demonstrative at a game. So I went that way with it. Not knowing what he would do with it. It just seemed natural to me.
Dave, I have actually been the guy who, let me put on my Philip Horkman voice, says the F word in the parking lot and been told that by the spousely half that she did not want to be married to the gentleman who said the F word in the parking lot. Jeffrey is that guy.
He definitely is that guy. He says the F word a lot and many other bad words. And I want to say, whereas Philip's character is sort of like Alan, my character is nothing like...
I do
sometimes say the F word, but the thing about the Jeffrey character is his spectacular inability to ever see that he may be wrong. No matter how often, it's very obvious to the entire world and all the events that result that he's very, very wrong about almost everything. He never accepts that. He always just figures, he blames everybody constantly. And he is kind of, as Alan said, we both have kids who play soccer. I live in Miami where soccer is taken quite seriously, especially soccer involving children, much, much more seriously than, life. And I've seen unbelievable parent behavior on the sidelines. And so I sort of imagine, what kind of person is such a jerk that he, in front of his kids, in front of his family, in front of everybody, just makes such an utter fool of himself over, 11-year-old girls playing soccer, and when the girls themselves don't even really care. And I thought, that's the guy that I'm gonna be in this book. And it really was a fun character to be, because I never had to worry about, would it be inappropriate? Everything that would be inappropriate would be what he would do.
You have a lot of fun with him, and one of the things I think that's so interesting is that for all his, he has a very unnuanced personality, but your prose and your portrayal is very nuanced, and we see a lot of things in him.
Did
as
you hear
readers.
That, Alan? My prose is very nuanced.
I'm going to have to reread the book. Apparently, I missed something.
My goal was to show you how he could be that way without him ever coming out of his character. But he's thinking and saying things that he thinks are really, correct, true, right things, but in such a way that it should be clear that he has no idea what he's really thinking or saying.
Well, as you were immersed yourself in this unpleasant character, did you find yourself taking on those characteristics, or did you just enjoy walking around the house in your skivvies saying?
Well, I do that anyway. Well, I did at one point. You mean you're talking about me beating up the Girl Scout? No, you heard about that?
No,
I don't think so. I think I would most basically be sitting here laughing and thinking, I wonder what's Wybell will do with this scene, more than I was thinking of transforming my own personal self into this horrible.
That was a big factor. We would write our chapters, and I'd send it off. Okay, you figure out what to do next, you know?
Yeah, he would put them in these ridiculous, these impossible plot situations. And leave it to me to figure out how to get them out of it. Well, we both kind of did that to each other. I would say revenge was a big factor in the writing of this book.
Yeah, it was. It was so much fun in the sense that there was. It was so unknown. You know what was going to the next chapter of your own book would be. You know,
wow. Because we understand there are authors who know that stuff ahead of time. What the book is going to actually say, be about, and everything. We never had that.
We never had that consideration. Even forget about problem. It was a collaboration in the sense that not only was in the writing, but the way we wrote it was very much like we were improvising a novel. You know, it was saying something, not knowing what the other person was going to say back at you, and then you took it and you went further with it, like a dialogue, you know, like any kind of an improv. It was we ad-libbed a novel.
And the tricky part became when Alan was telling me like all his ideas he had about where it could go and so on, and I had to remind him that it was actually due. We had to actually give them the book, because otherwise I think he would still be...
I'm still writing, by the way. I have some good places for them to still go before they come home.
But we kind of hit upon this idea of like a sort of a Zelig thing where they would, we didn't know this when we started the book. At the beginning, it was just like two guys in New Jersey and what, you know, things keep happening and happening and happening. But eventually it was too big for Jersey, as a saying in literary words, this is too big for Jersey. And it had to break out, cross the George Washington Bridge, and then it became too big for Manhattan. And we started moving them around the world. But at some point we had this idea, what if these guys who are really, you know, two schmoes, and one of them is just a jerk, and one of them is kind of exclusive, what if they are suddenly doing amazing things, you know, spectacular, you know, I mean, but don't know it. They're never really aware of what's happening. And that became really the fun part of it. How could, for example, they bring democracy to Cuba and not realize they had done this? You know,
they brought 2 million bananas to the hungry folks in Somalia, sort of unbeknownst to them, you know, and it was Brian Williams, which Dave put in it brilliantly, so who chronicled, you know, the activity that these two great liberators were doing.
They become international folk heroes. At first, they become internationally wanted terrorists. Then they're sort of both, and then they're folk heroes. But they never know this. It's never clear. They have no intention of doing any of these things. Philip, his guy, is still kind of doing what he thinks is the right thing. My guy is always doing the wrong, most selfish possible, obnoxious possible. You know, he stabs the other guy in the back a million times, but it keeps working out differently from what they think. Now, that became the real fun of it. Like, what else could they do without really knowing they're doing it?
I mean, as you're talking, I mean, I'm going back and I'm going, all right, we knew it was a feud. We knew that it would have consequences. It would build to something. But it really wasn't until, I know that at the George Washington Bridge when... Denise Rodica's insulin pump was mistaken for a bomb. Okay, I knew that, okay, we're getting into some sort of weirdness over here, okay? And it was a gateway into something bigger. But I didn't know until...
Until I said it just now.
Until you said it just now. I got to go. I'm telling you, I should read this book.
You should read the book. You should read the chapters that I wrote. He can't read his own because...
No, I can't. You saw the way I was reading before. I just can't read. But the fact is... it became this thing that slowly opened up. And once we got them onto that cruise ship, and we said, okay, fine, we're now going to be in international waters with this. And it's not Jersey. It's not no longer the New York metropolitan area. It's the globe. Okay. It pretty much liberated us. So, let's see where we're going to go now.
Yeah, and I have to say, thank God for Wikipedia, because neither Alan nor I is, you know, we're both humor writers, so we don't actually know anything about anything. So we had to look up where these kind like we had to figure out, well, where could you get to from Cuba, and how long would it take I don't know that we got any of that right, but we did go to Wikipedia and look.
What direction would you have to go? I remember writing to you once asking, how long would it take to fly from Yemen to Beijing, okay?
Or no, I think it was worth, like, first, at one point, he wanted to know what could be carried on a ship from Cuba, and he had, like, Toyotas or something.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And I said, Alan, they don't have Toyotas in Cuba.
But I have such great jokes about Toyotas.
They don't have anything in Cuba, Alan. So, and he occasionally, there were other little glitches, like at one point, and this is something any first-time novelist could do. Alan killed all the main characters. He seriously did. Well, he didn't kill them, but he left me with a chapter ending that there was no possible way the next chapter could start other than, and then they are all dead. It's like, Alan, we can't kill everybody.
Well, you know, something, once again, that's him being so picky, so picky. That was a point well taken, by the way, because how many? We only had like 110 pages at that point, and we couldn't end it there with this mass death.
You know, you were talking about the George Washington Bridge scene, and this is something you guys collaborate on very well, are set pieces. There are lots of great set pieces in here. And this is a novel of escalating challenges and egging one another on. And it must have been a lot of fun to create these set pieces. And as you say, just leave somebody hanging in with their, literally in their skivvies saying, what the heck am I going to do now?
Which is exactly what I would think when he would send me a chapter. We had this rule, no steering. So as Alan was saying, it's improvisational rules. You take what the other person give you, but the other person doesn't tell you where to go, you know? And so I would think when I had sent him a chapter, probably they'll do this now. That's what I'm thinking they should do. And he would have them do something completely different. And your instinct is to go, oh, no, that's not what they're supposed to do. But then you think, well, okay, we can try to. So,
you know, I'd get a chapter in my inbox and I go, oh, wow, okay. So sometimes I'd read it right away, and sometimes I would leave it towards the end of the day if I had things to do, and I gave it its own time. And I knew when I opened it that a couple of things would happen. One is I knew I'd laugh. Okay, that I knew. You were so committed to this character that the voice was just funny to me, okay, because you got into the inner workings of this man's incredible ego and his inability to see that somebody else might have another point of view that was valid, okay? It was just incomprehensible to him. It was never on his radar, okay? It was just, but I also knew that Dave, like he just said, would take it in a direction that, okay, fine. Wow. And I would take a day or so to let it sink in. And sometimes, I don't know if you did this, but there were some times where when I would start writing my chapter to advance the plot, you know, from what you just handed me, there were some times where I just started writing to see where my own writing would take me, as if I was improvising with myself. Okay, because I...
Now I have a headache.
You know something? I can show you how I did it. We can go chapter by chapter if you want.
That's kind of like something his character does behind the curtain at one point in the novel.
Indeed. Yes, indeed.
My character is into self-gratification and manages to self-gratify himself a number of times in a shipping crate at a key moment in the plot.
One of the things that's kind of remarkable about this book is as you're reading it, these are two people that, were they to walk in front of you in the parking lot, you might not step on the brakes.
That's an excellent way of putting it. Very accurate, yes.
And so this is a fabulous piece of what you could call maybe twit lit, where two characters are seriously unlikable, but yet we love them. We want to read about them. We want to find out what crazy, insane thing they're going to do, what completely inane reaction they're going to have to something wild and crazy is happening, and Philip's going to act like, you know, Mr. Rogers. And about making these guys likable.
Philip makes Mr. Rogers look like Charles Manson. Philip is such a goody two-shoes. It's and Wait, what was the question again? Oh, yeah.
Making these two guys likable and enjoyable to read about.
I didn't so much worry about whether my guy was likable. I mean, I really didn't want him to be likable at all. I thought Philip's character was basically likable. But as you say, kind of, he's just too good. He's always just, he's so earnest, so unbelievably nice and sweet. I don't know, Helen, how you wrote him sometimes. Because I think my part is so easy. I just have to be bad.
I was mindful of making him have a bit of a conscience, making him feel somewhat conflicted when he fell in love with the naked nun, thinking about his kids at home, you know, whether or not they were happy or sad that he was not home, and what their lives were like now that their dad was reputed to be an international terrorist. I try to ground it somehow because Dave's character was so without a moral compass, if you will, or a conscience. I figured that we had to at least give the semblance of responsibility and of human emotion, okay? Now, I'm not saying that the guy, you know, it breathes and sweats it, but I was mindful that to keep the difference between the two of them, he had to come from some place. Mind you, we're marking on an incredible curve here, okay? But he had to come from some place where he could be offended by you, okay? So I was mindful of that.
Yeah, my character is so obnoxious that his character, even his character, dislikes him, and he loves everybody and wants to love and wants to see the good in everybody.
But yeah, he says on a few occasions, you know, in particular when the truck goes over the cliff in Cuba and crashes at the bottom of the ravine, not knowing that one of the salamanders saved him. My guy was conflicted because, you know, here was a human life that was just killed. And
guy happily tries to sacrifice Philip's life to save himself routinely over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
He tried. At one point, I won't go into how this happened, but at one point they're tied together back to back and bears attack. And these are New York City bears, Central Park bears, zoo bears. And my guy immediately turns so that the Horkman side is facing the bears. That's the kind of guy I have.
Yeah, and but see, here was the interesting thing about Dave's writing of it. He would use my guy as a human shield against these grizzlies or black bears or whatever they were. And at the same time, you had them named Hansel and Gretel. They were a gift from, Japan or someplace in China. And I'm going, all right. So you'd have this and go, wow, what an awful person he is. And now, Hansel and Gretel are doing this. It was, you know, it was really fun. You know, it was actually fun to get into Dave's thinking in terms of what his character was doing. And it was full of surprise. As much as it was sort of predictable what his character could do or could say, Dave putting in those little things like that, wow, it caught you off guard a little bit. I really like that.
Well, I think that what one thing both of you do really well is you capture us on the level of language. It's just so much fun to read Jeffrey's stuff. And his and also, this is something that's very important and highly underrated in English prose writing, is the ability to use swear words in a manner that is like consistently funny. Don't overuse them, don't underuse them, but when you hit a man, they just nail it, and it's just hysterical. And you, on your side, Ellen, give us this guy who just kind of blithely thinks, well, I'm kind of sorry about the guy who I might have accidentally killed when he saw my face.
Yes, he killed him, but feels a little badly about it. Yeah, you know, and what made me laugh a lot with Dave's stuff when he sent it back to me, in addition to everything else I've just mentioned, is your use of capital letters. Okay?
I do use capital letters.
And it was great because they were so emphatic. You know, if I saw a douchebag in capital letters, I would laugh, you know, because it became a character trait. You know, the capitals, the exclamation points.
He's very emotional.
Distinctive, you know.
Very emotional man. But, you know, the thing is, when this has been optioned to be a movie, and which was Alan's doing. He's in the film world, and pretty much after he'd finished the second paragraph, he started sending it off to...
I just wanted to test the waters out there. Yeah.
It's like, we haven't written anything yet, really. And he sends me these emails as, you know, Steve Carell's people really like it. I go, like, what? We haven't got a book yet. We haven't got a plot. We have nothing. But anyway, but it did get optioned to be a movie. But it was clear right away, for I think to both of us, that the character, the movie will be about Philip. You can't really make a movie based on my guy because he's horrible. You know, he's going to be in the movie and he's going to be providing laughs in the movie, we hope. But the... no human watching the movie is going to want to relate to this despicable.
I mean, look, we're working on the outline now, and the best way to do it, we think at the moment, okay, and right now I have to be convinced otherwise, is you open on Philip, you see what his life is like, you take him to the soccer game to ref, you know, and his kids don't even play in that league anymore. They're older, they're out of that league, but he's a good guy and he likes breathing the fall air and he likes, you know, being a good citizen.
I can hear the soundtrack music.
Oh, well, absolutely. And then all of a sudden, this thing comes into his life. So you're absolutely right. I don't think, look, once they get together and they go forward, you know, it becomes a little bit more of a two-hander. But I think you faint in the direction that here's a guy, he's got a life, things are good, and then hello. You know?
Now, one of the things I think that's interesting in this book is when they first clashes tend to be, you know, have unfortunate results for the two of them. Then you kind of turn it around, and that just caught me by surprise. I expected that things keep going, getting worse and worse. From their perceptions, things are worse and worse, but from externally, they aren't. And I thought that was really brilliant because it kept us really engaged. It kept us rooting for them to keep fighting. And it's this kind of like push-me-pull-you effect for the humor and the plot that I think is very interesting and very crafty, although we experience it as just like, you know, trying not to spit milk out of our nose.
Wow, that's a great... At what point do you remember that we decided?
Yeah, we were talking about. Because you're absolutely right. As I say, first it starts out with like it's in suburban New Jersey, and you only go so far with that. I mean, I suppose you could make the whole thing about that, but we wanted it to get stranger than that. Then it becomes bad. Everything that happens to them makes their situation worse, which is. But then it becomes, as you say, then we at some point we said, what if they really started, you know, I think you brought up the term Nobel Prize.
We never really? Knew how to end this. But at one point we said, OK, here's a good chore, if you will. Try to make these guys get to a point where they were Nobel Peace Prize winners.
And that's when we had to bring Brian Williams in because they couldn't know what was happening to them. They had no way of knowing it. Their chapters, they're insular. They're just the two of them dealing with whatever's around them. We had to have some way of saying to the reader, but look what's actually happening. You know, outside of their awareness, all these amazing things they're doing. And then there's sort of like, we went around the world with that and we wanted to go one more place. And so we kind of came up with a set piece ending, that is, again, we hope, completely unexpected by the reader.
Absolutely.
Unexpected by the reader. It was unexpected by your co-author here. We were in China. Okay, I have no idea where to FedEx these guys to. I just know we're going to FedEx them somewhere, okay? So they go into a crate, and he's got his side, and we know what he does on his side. I got my side over here, and it's nailed shut, and it's shipped out. I didn't put a destination. I didn't know where they'd end up. So I send it off to Dave, and I go on my merry way for the next two or three days. A chapter comes back, and I go, they end up in it was in a warehouse, right? For what store or something? Like
Best Buy.
A Best Buy warehouse. And then the next thing I know, they're going into the arena in Tampa. You know, it's not like I'm going to ruin it, am I? They end up, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it. What's that?
Your call.
No, yeah, say it.
They end up at the Republican National Convention in Donald Trump's box, and I'm going, okay. This was one of the longer naps I had between chapters, you know?
Well, I was thinking, like, this was in, I think we wrote that in September or October. And I was thinking, well, you know, when this book comes out, the, you know, the political season's going to be going strong in the United States. And it would just be fun to have, what would happen if you injected these two people into that process, which is already silly enough process as it is.
It's, well, you know what?
You know, it's amazing that you managed to top it.
Yeah.
Wait, I mean, it hasn't all happened yet.
But what was interesting was it was exactly that, because, and it did have a certain logic to it in some illogical way, because, look, first of all, these guys could not know what they were doing. This is a pet shop owner, and it's a forensic plumber. So, it, you know, they couldn't mastermind what they did. So it had to be unwitting, okay? It had to be... They circumstantial, if
you
will.
But at this point, they become these symbols, so that everybody in the world thinks, you know, they know who they are, and they've created these you know, these guys don't realize they've been, you know, turned into these.
Oh, there were T-shirts with what do you call them? It was this
the Fantasmas de la Noche.
Yeah, the Phantoms of the Night. Okay, and then
but so the political process just sort of sucks them in and uses them, you know. Completely inappropriately.
Yeah, and then what happened was, to try to give it, once again, some sort of, excuse me, my language, logic, okay, I remember actually alluding to General Eisenhower being elected president. He had no political background, but he was a war hero. So why couldn't it happen to these two guys who brought democracy to Cuba and bananas to Somalia? You know, so...
Not mention peace in the Middle East.
And peace in the Middle East and Tiananmen Square. We did a nice job also. So, like I said, within... So try to at least allude to that this sort of happened in real life. It, sort of. I really...
Not too much, though.
Not too much. Hardly. Just a scintilla, you know. But we, you know, and look, we could very well have gone the Nobel Peace Prize route also, you know.
Well, we'll save that for the sequel.
Well, you know what it was? There was one point, you know, it was fairly early on, where we thought, okay, because these two guys were giving their accounts, right? They were in two different voices in alternating chapters. Where were they when they were telling this story? So we batted around ideas like, okay, maybe this was their Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This, we find out this is where they were when they were telling this story that we've been reading all along.
But we didn't, this is like too easy a twist to just have them go from being, you know, bad to suddenly they're loved and it ends with the Nobel. So we wanted to have them, we want to kind of bring them back and to where they started and in the end.
Now, you guys have a lot of fun with the media in this, from the instant logo phenomena to Brian Williams. So who wrote Brian Williams in?
Dave did.
You? Wow.
What?
Oh, no, that's interesting because you do such a great job.
Well,
my
background theoretically is journalism. So.
Theoretically.
No, but I've been a newspaper reporter and newspaper editor. And so I love to parody the style of writing that is newspaper journalism, where everything is authoritative and usually largely wrong. So that's what we did with it. We took, you know, how the news media, which never really know what's going on, as you know, if you've ever been the victim of a news media, how they take what they know and make it the story. And that's what happens to these guys. They, you know, they misunderstood them when they said they were terrorists. They misunderstood them when they said they were great liberators. They never really knew who they were, until they were running for president of the United States. So I really enjoy writing parody news stories.
And one thing too that brings to mind the other kind of major theme of this book is just the perception and misperception is really the driver of this book, in a sense, just back and forth, the back and forth perspectives, the way he sees one, the way Philip sees Jeffrey, the way Jeffrey sees Philip, the way they misconstrue one another's motives, the way they overreact to one another. That's an interesting driver for plot driver for a book.
Yeah, nobody ever knows what's really going on in this book. They don't. The world around them doesn't. Nobody ever knows what's going on.
They're just two guys who have been cast in circumstances that end up having results that no one knows the cause, no one knows the effect. We know the effect. We know the effect, but none of it is by design. Nobody could do that by design. Otherwise, there'd be peace in the world.
Now, this book includes many varieties of humor, most notably and most stomach-threateningly, potty humor.
I like to say we took the bathroom humor out of the bathroom. You know, a lot of it doesn't take place in an actual bathroom. Sometimes it's more submarine humor.
Submarine oriented.
Yeah.
It was once again. I mean, I would get a chapter and I go, okay, we got him in a submarine with this basically what they were like Navy SEALs. You know, the salamander unit and. God, how are they going to get out of this? And then I got to, as a reader, okay. Okay, we're going to his pants again. And I just sit there laughing.
Yeah, my guy has severe gastrointestinal issues in this book. Severe. And they,
among other things.
They play a key role in several plot developments.
And then it became so much fun for me because that, here was the problem. Not a problem, but it was a really interesting challenge because when you got us out of the submarine, okay, by virtue of diarrhea, okay, if you will, my guy, on the one hand, was thrilled that they were out of the submarine. On the other hand, how they got out of the submarine, he was so repulsed by. So it became this thing, you know, he was conflicted about the whole thing. And it was an interesting writing challenge, you know.
Now, when you guys were writing this back and forth, did you edit one another's pieces at all?
No. Every now and then, Alan would say, "I don't get this," or I would say, "Alan, you just killed all the characters," and then you know, you would go back and fix that. But there was no real editing of each other. And the one thing we did do was. And we kind of realized it together. We had them go to Cuba. And that was when we hadn't yet figured out about that they were going to turn from being bad guys to heroes. Totally figured that out. And so we started trying to, you know, figure out what's going to go on in Cuba. Neither one of us really knew because we didn't know where we were going. So we wrote a series of funny chapters, three or four of them, back and forth, funny. But we both almost realized at the same time, we're not getting anywhere. Nothing's
through really, lateral moves.
We're just treading water here, and the plot's not going anywhere. And so Alan, being the film guy, said, "Let's go back to this scene. This is the last scene where it doesn't repeat itself, and we'll start from there." And we did. And then that was when we started to see, okay, we can have them go all over the world. These guys, they can do what happened here. They can do it other places. We just have to figure out new ways for them to do it.
And that became its own challenge because, look, we had them on the way to Havana, not knowing what was going to happen in Havana. And I think that might have been, at least it was for me, I figured, okay, Dave will figure out what happens when they get to Havana. So I write a chapter on the way to Havana. And then we had three chapters in a row on the way to Havana. Okay.
we said it was
20 miles.
Neither one of us knew what was going to happen to me. And Al wrote, it's one of my favorite things he came up with, was the secure the radius. It's up to that point in military history, it had always been traditional to secure the...
They didn't have enough guys. All right, so they have maybe half the amount.
But Horkman had heard the secure the part, but he got it wrong. He got the geometry wrong. So he has them secure the radius, and it works.
It worked.
And they defeat the Cuban army. That was one of my favorite scenes. I mean, I sent you an email that day. So it just said, secure the radius.
Yeah, I know.
One of the things that makes this book funny is that there's a lot of stuff that's true. It's funny. There's a lot of it's funny because it's true humor. And for example, of his wife, he says the "it's your fault" voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we've all heard that voice, or maybe I haven't.
No.
So and you know, just in the general observation, especially now, the thin line between any of us and a terrorist is, you know, it's just a matter of perception. So I'd like you to just talk about, and the thing is that as a farce, this book really works. We believe it. I mean, you know, from each escalating in completely insane situation as readers. We're going with it. You know, we never question it. And that's a tough road to hoe.
You know, there was at one point, and I guess it was when we decided to go international with them, that I remember saying something to you either in person or in one of the emails. You remember the book, The Mouse That Roared?
Oh, yeah, Leonard Wibberly.
Oh, okay, fine. You got this little country that, you know, it's sort of poor. You know, declare war on the United States and they'll fix you, you know. And we go, okay, you know, they'll make it nice. And we go, okay, this is not without some sort of precedent when it comes to the unrealistic or the fantasy aspect of it, you know. And we did keep it in as much reality as we could, but it was not without, you know, we kept on alluding to, like in the movie, or even when we were writing the book, the original In-Laws came to mind with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin.
Oh, what a fabulous movie.
It was a great movie, you know, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Yeah, mind you, there wasn't a war there, and there was no real... But they were traveling. This became a road movie. This became Bing Crosby and Bob Hope, if they didn't like each other, you know?
And Bob Hope said very bad words.
Bob Hope had a foul mouth, you know? But what you just said is very interesting, though, because... With everything, Peckerman slept in the garage, okay? His wife didn't like him, and she banished him to the garage, and he slept there. It's not like he went to a motel.
No, no.
No, I'll go into the corner, and I'll stay there until you're ready to have me back in the house. And I, when you think about it, there is something very interesting about that. You know, as bawdy and as outrageous as he is, he said, okay, I'll sleep in the garage.
Peckerman's an interesting character because he's seemingly so mean and he's so violent and rude and cruel, but he's also, like many bullies, he's kind of chicken. And he's a
complete coward. He does, every time he has any opportunity to step up and do anything self-sacrificing or brave, he fails to do so. And any time he can sell out Horkman, no matter how long they've been together, he's still willing to let him die at the drop of a hat. And it's only a miracle that Horkman never actually... And meanwhile, Horkman rescues him, though, so...
Yeah, I mean, when they were on the boat, the ship that eventually, you know, brings the bananas to Somalia, I mean, here you had Horkman at the controls of a pirate, okay, who the pirate liked him and they got along. And what was Peckerman doing?
Getting
drunk and making banana daiquiris for everybody in the crew. So it was like, it's a guy who was
and
not...
And of course, it was actually Peckerman's fault that they crashed into Somalia.
Yeah.
But again, good things happen. Good things happen.
But, you know, one thing, too, that's very interesting. You guys say take some chances here, and there's some kind of, like, risky moments of humor. I mean, there's the scene in the Hamas... There's a scene where they're telling jokes that are just so bad.
This is
my
favorite.
There's a joke that is literally in bad taste.
This is my favorite.
Which one would that be?
This is my favorite scene.
Oh, I know which one.
My favorite scene in the book for me is when they're captured by Hamas. They're in a cave in Yemen, and they're supposed to make a TV broadcast. And the approach that the two of them take to that, I just love that scene. And I love the comedy routine. Guy set Alan up where I didn't know what he was going to do, and he has them do a comedy routine.
Well, he puts me there. They're going to go on TV. It was Dave's idea to go, okay, fine. If you say... someone left a cake out in the rain, okay, that's the signal for jihad, okay? But if you say one thing, one syllable different, okay, that means put down all your arms and there's, the lion will lie down next to the lamb, okay? Everybody will be peace. So I'm going, okay, fine. And I'm going, all right, they're going to be on television, live television. Everybody, whoever gets, Al Jazeera on their set, you know, is going to see this. And... I think it was all of a sudden you had to turn them into Abbott and Costello, all right? And why? Why would they know these jokes? Why would they have this arsenal, this repartee, these two people who don't like each other, just because of guns to their head, you don't automatically turn into Laurel and Hardy?
Except that my guy really views himself as a performer, and he's so clueless that he views this as a real shot. Horkman's like, don't you understand? They're declaring it. And Mike goes, what's wrong with a little G?
Don't you, were, did you have any trepidation at you know, like making fun of Hamas?
Yeah, as a Jew, I must say, every time I worked, wrote the word Hamas or jihad, I'm going, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Yeah, I was very, very conscious of that. And I still am.
Dave, you did have to bring in pirates, didn't you? That was de rigueur.
It was, but because I am responsible for International Talk Like a Pirate Day becoming famous. Is that why you're saying that?
Well, yeah.
We brought the pirate, but I actually think, I'm pretty sure that the idea of having the boat hijacked by pirates was Mr. Zweibel's idea.
I think so. I think so because they were on the tanker. Right?
Yes. And freighter.
What do you call
it's
it?
It's a freighter.
A freighter?
It has bananas. If they were in a tank, it would be like a tank full of bananas. What would be the point of that?
Well, you know, I remember going on Wikipedia and going, okay, what cargo ships? Okay.
This is when he wanted to put Toyotas on the ship from Cuba.
Yeah, that was my first pass, and I'm going, they're taking Toyotas. And he goes,
they don't make Toyotas in Cuba.
That's why I figured they had to import them. But he goes, no, they're leaving. You know, they would be exporting. I go, oh, yeah, you're right.
Probably so we looked up them in Ethiopia as well.
Well, true. Exact. Good point. Now, see, that's what I'm up against here. he would have a freighter leaving Cuba with a boatload of Toyotas for Ethiopia.
And I actually looked up, oh, okay, fine. What kind of boat would have Toyotas and what kind of crates would they be in?
We went back and forth, and I told them that there could be bananas. That'd be the only thing they could be exporting out of Cuba could be bananas.
You know, I belligerent, okay, fine. So there's bananas, you know.
Which was good because it led to banana daiquiris.
Well, what happened was...
Yeah, we had rum and bananas on this boat.
Well, pirates drink rum, and it was bananas.
No, that's right. That's how it happened. Now I'm remembering.
Absolutely.
Now
we had the two ingredients, at least the two major ingredients. What we tried to do, once we left the mainland...
I can't remember what question we're answering now.
You know something? I think it was something about your car.
Okay.
It became this thing where let's try not to repeat ourselves. You know, each place we go, you know, either the result or the method... Let's not duplicate ourselves. So that became a fun challenge, you know. And I think pirates, well, there were no pirates in Cuba, so hello.
Now, one thing that struck me as I was reading this, both of you guys, you've written a lot of novels, but...
I wrote one novel.
You wrote one novel. But this is a kind of an odd medium for you guys to be working with in terms of addressing this kind of back-and-forth novel. And I think that maybe the dialogue that... The fact that this was essentially a dialogue between the two of you really helped that drive the novel writing parts of this to give it that kind of story arc.
Yes. I mean, totally. We viewed it, I think, much more as an email exchange in a way than we did writing a novel, at least at the beginning, because we didn't have a book contract or anything else. It was really, would we even have anything? You know, I would say it was a couple months before we thought, well, yeah, we probably do have something here, before we finally agreed to show it to anybody.
Well, yeah, I remember fairly early on, but we were well into the process.
I mean, he's already sending it to the movie industry, but as far as an actual book
I'm sending it out to people, you know, in movies. But I remember there was one point where Dave said, you said in an email, at what point should we show this to someone? We arbitrarily said 100 pages. Okay?
That's right. That's right.
Let's finish the chapter either before, you know, 100 pages, you know. And so when we got to it, we were making each other laugh. And I did show it to a couple of close friends, you know, whose opinion that I liked. And they were very encouraging about it. But they're also dented cans the way they are, the way we are. So I'm going, okay, maybe people with the correct number of chromosomes we should show it to. And when we sent out the 100 pages, we gave it to our agents who then gave it to our respective publishers, you know. And when it was received well, then we looked at each other and went, gee, maybe this is okay. You know, we knew that we were onto something, but what it was, we didn't know, but people liked it, you know, so... We went forward.
The timing and pacing is all in humor. And the timing and pacing of this is impeccable, except for the poor person who has to read it, which is essentially you sit down and have to read it for the next 16 hours or 4 hours, however fast you read it. And you guys have a great sense of timing with in both within and on the larger scale, too, because this is like a series of nested loops. And that's an interesting way to set up the comic timing and to set up the timing of a novel.
I think it's like scenes in a movie. By both of us, I didn't know we were going to end up with a movie option, but I thought of, from the very start, scenes. I don't know about you, you know, in terms of the quick hit scenes.
Yes. You know, what I was mindful of was that these chapters couldn't be too long. You didn't want to get caught in one person's voice for too long because you didn't want to lose the other guy's perspective of it. So they were all like 3-4 pages at most. Mm-hmm. You know, I would always, you know, when I thought I was at the end of my chapter, I would always look at the word count. You know what I mean? It was always like between 1,200. A big chapter was 1,500 words, you know? So that was cool. But it became evident to me, I guess around the time of the George Washington Bridge, that early, that, okay, we're writing, as you said before, set pieces. And the movie aspect of it, even if we never got a movie contract, even if we never got a publishing contract, okay, if this scene happens, what would be the dynamic of it? And started writing, describing picture, actually. Mm-hmm. I was conscious of it, yes.
Now, I'm hoping you guys have something else cooked up. It seems like you had enough fun doing this one.
Yes, we don't have it cooked up yet, but we're both tugged in other directions, you know, with other projects and you know, obligations. However, just like I badgered Dave the first time, I'm going to make sure that we're not going to let this slip away, you know, because we're going to come up with two other characters, another circumstance, and maybe, you know, not to repeat ourselves. So that will be the trick here. You know, two other guys, two different voices, another situation. Let's see where it takes us. But I'm going to make sure we do it.
And we're going to do it all in Russian, just to have a twist to it.
Well, then you can call it Crime and Punishment.
That's good. Write that down.
Oh, okay.
You be crime and I'll be punishment. All right, done. It's done.
There's something there. Okay, keep talking. This is good.
Yeah, like how would it open?
I guess.
Good. Write this down.
Dave's character would be a nebbish who trips and accidentally kills somebody, and Alan's character is
the prosecutor.
Is a guy whose sphincter is so tight it threatens to emerge from his throat, and is a policeman. There you go.
I love it. I'm loving it.
You know something? Boy, oh boy. Good going.
I've been speaking with Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel. Their new book is Lunatics. They certainly are not lunatics. Thank you for joining me, Dave and Alan.
Thanks for having us.
This was really fun. This is really fun.
This is the most we've ever talked about our book.
Yeah, and to somebody who actually read it and enjoyed it. That's a combination.
You know.
No, thank you for taking the time to appreciate it, and I'm glad you did because...
Oh, shut up, Alan.
I started out as a kid. I used to send in jokes to these comedians. Okay.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.